On behalf of Penn Law and Temple Law Federalist Societies, I would just like to welcome everyone to our debate with Professors Yu and Prakash on executive powers. Thank you all for choosing to spend this rainy in Philadelphia afternoon with us, and we hope to see you at many of our events in the future. A special thank you to the Federalist Society's Article 1 Initiative and Regulatory Transparency Project for sponsoring this debate today. If you're new to Zoom webinar format, you can find the Q&A function along the bottom of your screen, and we encourage you to submit your questions throughout the discussion so we can have a more robust Q&A towards the end of the hour. And with that, please allow me to introduce our first speaker, Professor John Yu. John Yu is the Emanuel Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley, a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. At Berkeley, Professor Yu directs the Public Law and Policy Program at the Korea Law and the Korean Law Center. Professor Yu has published nearly 100 scholarly articles on the subjects of national security, constitutional law, international law, and the Supreme Court. He's also a regular contributor to the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Washington Post, among many others. And he's also been a columnist for his hometown newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer. So go Philly. His latest book, Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, discusses the topic of today's debate, presidential powers. He's also written books on the subjects of war, international law, constitutional law, geoeconomics, and executive power. Professor Yu is the graduate of Yale Law School, after which he went on to serve in all three branches of our government as an official in the U.S. Department of Justice, General Counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee under Chairman Orrin Hatch of Utah, and a law clerk for the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and Federal Appeals Court Judge Lauren Silberman. So thank you, Professor Yu, for speaking with us today, and I will now pass it along to Lorenzo Raboni, President of the Temple Law Federalist Society, to introduce Professors Prakash and Professor Green.
Thank you. Professor Sai Prakash is a professor of constitutional law, foreign relations law, and presidential powers at UVA Law, where his scholarship focuses on separation of powers, particularly executive powers. Professor Prakash has published op-eds in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times. At the request of Democrats and Republicans, he has testified before Congress on matters of presidential removal, the Mueller report, and how Congress might better check the presidency. Professor Prakash is the author of Imperial from the Beginning, the Constitution of the Original Executive, which considers the presidency of the founders, and his most recent book, The Living Presidency, an Originalist Argument Against Its Ever-Expanding Powers, focuses on the modern presidency. Professor Prakash is a graduate of Yale Law School, where he received the John M. Oden Fellowship in Law, Economics, and Public Policy. He subsequently clerked for Judge Lawrence H. Silberman of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit and for Justice Clarence Thomas of the U.S. Supreme Court. After practicing in New York for 2 years, he served as a visiting professor at the University of Illinois College of Law and as an associate professor at Boston University School of Law. He then spent several years at the University of San Diego School of Law as the Herzog Research Professor of Law. Prakash has been a visiting professor at Northwestern University and the University of Chicago. He also has served as a James Madison Fellow of Princeton University and visiting research fellow at the Hoover Institution of War and Peace at Stanford University. He currently serves as a Miller Center Senior Fellow. Moderating the debate is Professor Craig Green. Professor Green is a professor of law at Temple University. He has taught and written in the fields of administrative law, American legal history, separation of powers, and constitutional history. He has published articles concerning wartime detention, federal common law, judicial activism, precedential interpretation, and constitutional history, among many other legal topics. Professor Green is also a graduate of Yale Law School and has recently earned a doctorate from Princeton in legal history for completing his dissertation, Creating American Land, A Territorial History from the Albany Plan to the U.S. Constitution. Professor Green previously worked for the Justice Department in the George W. Bush administration after clerking for Merrick Garland and Louis Polak. Thank you to all the professors for agreeing to be here today. We look forward to this discussion, and with that, I will pass it to Professor Green to commence the debate.
Great. I'm really pleased to be here, and obviously I'm just mainly to get out of the way of these two debaters or perhaps discussants. But I think the only thing I wanted to introduce with is I think maybe there's going to be a debate about certain kinds of evidence, what it means, and maybe the role of originalism. And I just wonder whether any of those things will add up to a structural set of presumptions, because I sort of wonder whether whoever carries the burden of proving the affirmative on the side of either legislation or presidential power may have the difficulty. I think with that, I think the by the rules of the debate or whatever circumstances you describe it, I think, Professor Yu, I think you're to start, perhaps.
Thanks, Craig. It's nice to see you. And thanks to the Penn and Temple Federal Societies for inviting me and my friend Cy to come debate presidential power. Originally, when we agreed, I thought we were going to be able to come in person. I'm a native Philadelphian. To prove it, I have one of the rarest things in existence here on the West Coast, my Wawa coffee mug. I was hoping to come back to Philly because, you know, if you look, that thing comes apart. I mean, yeah, it was definitely made in Philadelphia because it's held together by tape, not even glue, not even a screw. It's held together by a two-sided piece of foam tape. So I have to come back to Philly every 2 or 3 months and replace the damn thing. So I'm sorry to see my city going through such difficulty right now. I've just been reading about it in the paper, talking to my mom about it. I hope things get back to normal pretty soon. And I think all of us as lawyers and professors and students, you know, we should be thinking about ways to prevent these kind of things from happening in the future. Of course, we have to see what all the facts are from the investigation, but of course, we don't, I remember when I grew up in Philadelphia, even then police relations with the city were always difficult. I grew up when Frank Rizzo was the head of the police, and then he became mayor. And there was a famous picture of him. I remember seeing as a kid showing up at a protest with a tuxedo on because he came from a ball. But he had a billy club in his cummerbund, and here's a picture of him coming out of a car, pulling his billy club out. So that was the way Philadelphia was. The Philadelphia that I grew up in, of course, is very different than the one you all are in now. I grew up in the Philadelphia of the movie Rocky, where I sometimes watch it now. I think people need a translator to decipher his Philadelphia accent. But to me, it all sounds like the Queen's English. Mm-hmm. So it's great to be here with you all, and I hope we'll get a chance in the future to come visit Penn and Temple. So I started writing this book actually 4 years ago about Trump because I actually was not a supporter of President Trump's. I was actually quite worried about Trump's relationship with the Constitution, which I made known at the time, primarily because Trump's a populist, and populists always campaign on the theme of overthrowing the status quo and undoing the way business is conducted in the Capitol. And if anything represents the status quo, it's the Constitution and the traditions and practices that have formed around it. But I have to say, over the last 4 years, I think Trump's political and personal disruptiveness, I think, have so made people crazy that it's often his critics that are considering and proposing serious constitutional change. So let's just take a look at the process that just ended on Monday night, the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. I think someone Cy and I have both known for more than two decades now. Presidents have had vacancies at the Supreme Court open up in the last year of their terms several times. I believe presidents have nominated someone every time a vacancy has appeared in the last year of their presidency. There's nothing strange or unwarranted about that. Whether she should have been confirmed in that last year of a presidency is really a question for the Senate. It's not really even an issue of presidential power so much. And it was the Senate that decided when the same party controls a presidency and the Supreme Court, they confirm them. That's actually happened, I think, to almost all but one of the nominees who've been put forward in that situation. And when the parties have been different, as it were, was 4 years ago, the Senate has rarely confirmed the nominees. Imagine what would have happened if there were actually a rule. In fact, this used to be called, when I was in the Senate, worked in the Senate, it was actually called the Biden rule. And actually before that, it was called the Thurman rule, for Strom Thurmond. This idea that no one should ever be confirmed in the last year of a presidency. That would have deprived us of some of our greatest justices in history. Those of you who are into legal history, you may remember the Chief Justice John Marshall, was both nominated and confirmed after Thomas Jefferson had won the election of 1800. I also went back and looked, and I saw that Louis Brandeis and Benjamin Cardozo were also justices who'd been nominated, who'd been confirmed in the last year of presidency. Both, I think, many would say, some of the greatest judges we've ever had in our nation's history. So it seems to me the normal response to that would be for Trump's critics to say, okay, next time we control the Senate and the presidency and a vacancy occurs in the last year of our term, we'll confirm people too. But instead, the response has been, as we're seeing it play out right now, we're going to seriously consider packing the Supreme Court, adding six justices, expanding the court by 2/3. I think that is such an overreaction, a threat to constitutional norms. Certainly, I would say, admit, constitutionally, Congress can change the size of the Supreme Court as it wishes. But since 1869, we've had this idea, it's not that nine is a magic number, but that we shouldn't try to manipulate the size of the Supreme Court, the number of justices, because we want to manipulate it into getting the results we want. It's also Trump's critics who are now seriously proposing doing away with the Electoral College, either through amendment itself or through something called the National Popular Vote Initiative, which where states would all agree to give their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote, which would pretty much, I think, undo the way we've chosen presidents in our country for 230 years. You've got people who are now arguing that when the federal government sends law enforcement to cities during this period of unrest, that this is akin to fascism and it's a foreign occupying army. These are not crazy blog postings, but these are in serious publications like the op-ed pages of the New York Times. You have Trump's critics promising now to create a permanent independent counsel who would use criminal law and investigation to resolve what I think of as policy disputes. And you have the Green New Deal, which promises to nationalize huge parts of our economy, the energy, transportation, even housing sectors. I think that's where you see real constitutional change, even revolution being proposed. And in contrast, I think, and this I think has been the surprise, is that Trump has been left relying, has the whole field to rely on traditional precedent, traditional practices. And has he's really been using the Constitution, I think, more as a defensive shield than a sword to advance his agenda. The two great constitutional controversies of his presidency have been the Russia collusion investigation and impeachment. In both cases, Trump, I think, tried to reassert the Spartan 18th century constitutional idea of the executive branch as concentrating power into a single person, the president, but someone who's not a monarch, someone who's elected. But that person who we choose then has direct authority over the people in the executive branch who carry out law enforcement under the Take Care Clause. And then the people who carry out foreign policy. And I think of both the Russia collusion investigation and impeachment, both in part are controversies that were sparked by people who are members of the 20th century progressive constitution. And I think that's an idea that came up with Woodrow Wilson. I know Professor Green is a graduate of Princeton. I don't know if we're allowed to mention Woodrow Wilson's name. I should have given out a trigger warning before I said the words Woodrow Wilson. I think Cy has also been at Princeton. So you guys tell me if I'm allowed to talk too much about Woodrow Wilson. But it was really Wilson's idea. The guy was a genius, but his idea, which I think he gathered from Europe, particularly from Germany, was the idea of a professionalized government where the all important decisions are too important for politics. They should be made by independent, scientific, technical, professional experts, and that they should be, rather than under the 18th century constitution controlled by the president, they should be kept as far away from politics as possible. And so I think in the Russia collusion investigation, you saw the system respond to Trump. I think Trump had the constitutional authority to fire Jim Comey, but you saw a system say, how dare he? How dare president fire the head of the FBI, who's an independent law enforcement official? How dare he fight with Robert Mueller, the special counsel? Also, if there was anybody who's the gold standard of the independent professional prosecutor, it's Bob Mueller. Think of impeachment. How dare Trump, with his unorthodox, some think even crazy views about foreign policy, interfere with how the interagency process defines the national interest and the traditional ways we conduct diplomacy. So I think oftentimes there's this theme in the media and criticism that Trump is actually overturning the constitutional order. I actually think of him as trying to reassert what were the original 18th century origins of the Constitution against this much larger bureaucratic 20th century progressive constitution created by Woodrow Wilson, but really firmly established by FDR, and then I think put on steroids by LBJ, really. I think in the areas where you see a lot of criticism, for example, building the border wall or the travel ban, those are actually cases where Trump hasn't really claimed presidential power. These are cases where Trump has really asserted delegated statutory power. And I think the real dynamic that's going on here is that Congress has vested enormous power in the executive branch through delegations of things like spending or control over immigration, which is easy for any president to trigger. President Obama, and it's not even President Obama, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Reagan, they all, even Carter, all used these powers over national emergencies or control over delegations to pursue their agendas. And Congress is happy to do that because it gives Congress the ability to escape political responsibility for what are often very difficult policy choices. The last thing, let me just close here. The area I think where Cy and I disagree the most would be in foreign policy and war. And here again, I think you see the last dynamic I was talking about at work. There are people who think, like Cy, that Congress has to decide on war, has to declare war before presidents can go ahead and wage it. I actually think this is not a correct reading of the constitutional text. But we know that presidents have been using force abroad for many, many decades without congressional approval. I think Congress has plenty of tools to stop any president wants to. It has the power of the purse, which I think it easily gives it the power to cut off any modern war that it wants to. But the real dynamic, I think, going on is that presidents under the Constitution are responsible for the security of the country. The presidency is designed, as it's described by the framers, to act with decision and secrecy and speed and energy. They're going to have an incentive to try to respond to foreign threats. Congress could stop presidents if they want, but instead, what do? They fully fund an enormous offensive military, one that doesn't actually hang around very much in the continental United States. We have an expeditionary military, which is designed to fight abroad so that wars never get here. If Congress doesn't want presidents to wage those kind of wars, they can easily put a stop to it, but they don't want to because that would be a politically difficult choice. They don't want to be accountable for any possible failures in war. They can always say they supported the troops when the war goes well. The thing, and here I'll close, the thing that sort of upended matters is that Trump has kind of turned the politics of war and treaties upside down. It used to be the paradigm that presidents were seen as the more warlike, the more adventuresome branch, and Congress was one trying to restrain them. Actually, Trump has invoked the commander-in-chief power to reduce our engagements and commitments abroad. So Congress is now actually probably the more warlike branch. Trump has been, pulled the United States out of Syria. He's pulling us down to zero in Iraq. He's trying to withdraw from Afghanistan. He's even talked about moving troops out of Germany and Japan, where they've been since the end of World War II. If Congress really were in charge of policy in war and really dictated things and the president just carried out, which is the paradigm for domestic affairs, how can Trump get away with realigning all of these American forces abroad and actually reducing our war commitments when a Congress clearly wants to keep them? So thank you very much for bringing with me. I look forward to hearing Cy from Professor Green and from all of you.
Thanks very much. Professor Prakash, about 15 minutes or so?
Yeah, sure. So it's great to be with you folks today. Great to be with the Quakers and the Owls. I don't know what would happen if the Owls attacked the Quakers. I suspect the Quakers would have to, allow the attack to continue. I'm really pleased that 81 people are on this Zoom call. And, John's a humble person, but I'm not. So, here are our books. This is John's book, Defender in Chief. This is my book, The Living Presidency. Our talks are based on our books. If you go on the web, you'll see a picture of John standing next to the president with the president smiling, holding this book. So I encourage you to do that. and you won't find a picture of the president holding up my book. Maybe that will happen later, maybe on election night or something. So my book isn't about Trump at all. It's about what the presidency has become. And to understand what it's become, you have to know what it was. So I'm just going to sketch the original presidency really quickly before moving to what our presidency is today and why it's become what it is today. So the presidency of the founding was designed to be super powerful. Don't kid yourself to think that it was a weak presidency. The president had authority over the bureaucracy. The presidency had authority to execute the laws. The presidency had a very powerful pardon authority. The presidency had a share in legislation through the veto. The president could make treaties with the Senate's consent. The president could, of course, shape the bureaucracy by appointing officers again with the Senate's consent. This is an executive far more powerful than any that existed at the founding. If you compare it to the Pennsylvania executive, you see that the Pennsylvania executive is a plural executive, and it's a plural executive precisely to weaken it vis-a-vis the Pennsylvania legislature, right? A plural executive is slower. It's harder to come to consensus. A unitary executive has that energy and decision, et cetera, that Hamilton discussed. One second.
Size, our arguments is always shrouded in darkness and impenetrable to most normal people.
That's right. It's a secret argument. So they create this powerful executive, but it's hemmed in by three constraints. It's got to faithfully execute the laws. It can't twist the laws through interpretation. It can't make the laws, right? It can exercise this veto. Seems obvious to us. It's less obvious to us, unfortunately, in the modern era. President can't make treaties without the Senate's consent. Constitution doesn't say that, just says the president can make treaties by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, but the implication is he obviously can't make any treaties without the two-thirds consent of the Senate. And then finally, I disagree with John. I think the power to declare war is the power to decide, among other things, whether to go to war. In the 18th century, nations who started wars were described as having declared them. And in the 18th century, you had formal declarations, these pieces of paper, but you also had informal declarations. Again, the commencement of warfare was, to use someone from the 18th century's words, the strongest declaration of war. Why? Because it signaled that you were having recourse to war. You had decided to wage war. And in the 18th century, most wars were not declared with some piece of paper. They were declared from the mouths of cannons. We have this on the word of the first English Prime Minister, Sir Robert Walpole. So if you look at the era, most wars were not begun or commenced with a piece of paper. They were commenced with informal declarations of war. When the Constitution granted this power to the president, it assumed that the president or the chief executive no longer could wage war on his own authority. He had to go through this process. He could recommend war, he could veto war, but he could not wage it on his own authority. And that's what people said prior to the Constitution. That's what people said after the Constitution. That's what Washington, Jefferson, Madison, even Hamilton, the apostle of executive power, they all said, presidents can't take us to war. Congress has to declare war first. So that's the 18th century executive. Flash forward two centuries, and these features of the executive aren't with us anymore. We know, as John said, that presidents wage war all the time. Korea is the most famous example. The most recent example would be Libya, where Barack Obama took us to war in a war of regime change for months, right? Until, you know, he was, you know, able to succeed with the help of NATO there. But he took us to war there. He declared war, contrary to what the Constitution provides. What about treaties? Well, we don't make treaties anymore pursuant to Article 2. They're rarely made that way. Why? Because presidents have better ways of making treaties today. What do today? They make sole executive agreements to cover agreements that in the past would have been made by treaty, thereby bypassing the two-thirds requirement in the Senate. Or they make so-called congressional executive agreements where they secure the majority support of the House and the Senate, but don't secure the two-thirds support of the Senate. And so obviously it's gonna be far easier to make treaties if you don't comply with the treaty clause. If you do so unilaterally through so-called sole executive agreements, or if you do so with the consent of Congress, but outside the two-thirds requirement. The two-thirds requirement was there for a reason, right? It was designed to ensure that treaties weren't made that were detrimental to the rights of states. It is always useful. It's always a useful imprimatur to have a majority vote in Congress to support executive action, but it's not necessary. You don't need a majority vote in Congress to pardon someone. And you don't need a majority vote in Congress to make a treaty. You need two-thirds of the Senate. This innovation arose in the 20th century when Franklin Roosevelt misread earlier precedents and concluded that Congress could authorize the president to make treaties. And that's how we have NAFTA. That's how we have the USMCA. And then finally, with respect to law execution, what we've seen is presidents more and more of Congress invested with interstitial legislative authority courtesy of the Chevron doctrine. And then finally, willing and able to twist statutes to accomplish either needful policy goals or to implement their agendas, their reelection agendas. So when you're thinking of sort of maybe useful action items for the executive, you might think the automobile bailout was a good idea. That's what George Bush thought, and that's what Barack Obama thought. The problem was there was no authorization or appropriation to bail out the automobile companies. Congress was thinking about enacting an auto bailout, but the Senate wouldn't pass the bill, even though the House did. George Bush thought this was too important to leave to ordinary politics and the Constitution. He just funded the bailout of the automobile companies out of the financial institution bailout. And Barack Obama continued the policy. No statutory authority for this. Or take the insurance company subsidies that Obama doled out in the wake of the passage of the ACA. The ACA authorized insurance company subsidies, but did not appropriate funds. The Obama administration understood this and went to Congress, said, please appropriate the funds. The Republican Congress said, hell no. And then the Obama administration did a 180-degree flip and said, oh, you know what? We don't need your appropriation. We're just going to read the ACA as if it appropriated the funds. A clearly silly argument, embarrassing given what they had asked for earlier, but they did it because they thought it was necessary to salvage the ACA. Maybe they were right that it was necessary to salvage the ACA, but it's a blatant violation of our Constitution. And you sort of see this over and over again with respect to, you know, things that are needful, but also things that advance the president's reelection agenda. And I'd lump in there President Trump's wall spending. The president got $1.5 billion in 2019, courtesy of Nancy Pelosi and negotiations with her. That wasn't enough money for his lights. He wanted more. He couldn't get more through that negotiation process. So he declared an emergency and availed himself of some Pentagon funds, redirected them towards the wall. Now, he wasn't the first president to declare a faux emergency, to say something was an emergency that wasn't, and to use statutory authority tied to the declaration of an emergency. He probably won't be the last. But to me, this is an example of misreading a statute. There are statutes that give the president discretionary authority to do things whenever he thinks it's necessary, to do things whenever he thinks it's useful. And there are statutes that give him so-called emergency authority. It is a mistake to read these two sets of statutes as if they provide the same standard for accessing the additional statutory authority. An emergency is something different than something that's merely necessary. Marshall made this point in McCulloch, where he compared necessary and the necessary and proper clause with absolutely necessary used elsewhere in the Constitution. It's the same exact point. Trump wanted more money for his wall. He wanted a big, beautiful wall with a big, beautiful door, and he got more money through this faux declaration. So increasingly, presidents are willing to misinterpret and twist statutes to, again, accomplish needful goals that many of us might favor, but also to advance their electoral agendas. You might think some of this mortgage relief that President Trump has tried to accomplish through regulatory action also fits that bill. And the end result is presidents really no longer think of themselves as defending the Constitution. They don't really believe that they have to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Instead, they view themselves as having an option to amend the Constitution through practice, right? The Frankfurter opinion from Youngstown, where he talks about practice is putting a gloss on the Constitution, executive branch officials love this passage because they too can create practices that put a gloss on the vesting clause of Article 2 and on the commander-in-chief clause. And so, you know, presidents are often citing what other presidents have done and saying, I'm just doing what he did. And if he did it, it must be legal, and therefore I can do something similar as well. And so the reason why I called the book The Living Presidency is I wanted to draw a contrast to Arthur Schlesinger's book, The Imperial Presidency, a famous book from the 1970s. But I also wanted to draw a comparison to the idea of a living constitution. Right? If a living constitution is such a good idea, why is a living presidency so bad? Why is an imperial presidency so bad? If an imperial Congress is such a good idea, a Congress that has far broader legislative powers than in the past, see the New Deal revolution with respect to the Commerce Clause. If living rights are a good thing, see the, you know, the Warren Court's expansion, the Warren and Burger Court's expansion of constitutional rights in some areas and the curtailment of rights in other areas. What's so wrong with the living presidency? And so one of my claims in the book is that the living presidency is a consequence of the theory of a living constitution. In fact, it's sort of the poster child for it, because the presidency is best able to advance a constitutional vision, get people in the public to endorse it, get co-partisans to endorse it. He's the 800-pound gorilla of the living constitution, and that's why the presidency has been so successful in expanding the authority of the presidency over the last several decades, I think far more successful than his counterparts. He also, of course, appoints justices who are apt to endorse his constitutional vision. I mention other reasons in the book for the advancement of the presidency, the rise of political parties, and the role that the president plays as party chieftain. What this means is that whatever the president does, especially in advance of the party's agenda, will be supported by 40 or 50 or 60% of the country. And that portion of the country and the party are not going to criticize him. If Joe Biden, you know, spends more money to advance some Democratic agenda, he's not going to be criticized for it. And, you know, Trump only faced muted criticism from his party for the wall, in part because a goodly portion of the Republican Party favors the wall. So we've had a number of changes in our politics, changes our conception of the presidency. Think of all the crazy expectations of our presidents and what that does predictably to the minds of presidents who feel like they're going to be blamed for things outside of their control. Why not grasp for still greater powers to meet those outsized and absurd expectations? So I could say more, but I want to leave time for your awesome questions and Craig's questions as well. So thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you very much. Those were great. So I think I'm going to take my moderator's prerogative and maybe alternate my questions with ones that come in. And certainly there's lots more room in the queue for the latter as they come in. You know, our topic, I guess, nominally is the true powers of the presidency. And I guess I'm at least hearing three possibilities for that truth. One is, and I'm not sure quite what to call it, the originalism version. We'll call it the originalist's decade, or sometimes I feel like originalism can stretch backward in time to sort of British precedence and forward to anything with an 18 in front of it. But maybe the originalist's decade, some notion of anchoring a presidential, true presidential power in that decade right around the Constitution. And then another approach, which is based on tradition. Tradition also, for historians, a very fraught term, what counts as a tradition as opposed to an aberration. And then maybe a third vision, which was just the one that Professor Prakash was referring to at the end, that the presidency is what the president and the American public and the constitutional adjudicators make it. That you have these live present tense institutions and forces that craft and forge norms and values and restraints where text and indeed even Hamilton in his Broadway, formerly Broadway, incarnation can't really control. And I wonder if that's part of the debate, between these three visions of what the true powers of the presidency are. And I think in that sense, where the true law, if that's the right noun, surrounding the presidency exists. I don't know if that's a helpful way to think about it. Is that the disagreement, you think, between the two of you? I guess either one of you wanted to say.
Why don't you go first, John?
So that's an interesting way of putting it. So I would call your third category the common law presidency. Maybe that's the title for the next book, but that's the, yeah, this idea that the president, yeah, you can write it. I'm tired of writing about the president. It's this is the presidency we have in act, the presidency in action, probably another good title for a book. Right? So that's the accumulation of, you know, having worked in the executive branch is how it works. Or you, I think all of us have worked in the executive branch. It's a combination of the text and judicial precedent and practice. And a lot, and so a lot of it is not in cases because a lot of it never gets adjudicated. A lot of it is about fighting with Congress. A lot of it is about what agencies do in an unreviewable way. So that whole bundle of sort of what we would almost think of as common law precedents, I think is the presidency now. I think Cy is arguing against that. And so I think Cy is more like your first category, the idea that you could probably reduce the presidency to a laundry list of powers, which you divine in an originalist way, and they do not change. They don't expand. They don't get smaller either, but they are fixed. And so I guess the category I'm in is two, although I use the same methodology. But I think the founders had a different view of executive power than they did of the legislative power. I think Cy's approach, you know, your first category, Professor Green, is this idea, the idea of fixed enumerated powers. Of course, that's the way we interpret Article One. But I think the founders, as original, even if you're an originalist, you want to give you know, full effect to their understanding. They didn't think of the executive power that way. They talk about it as a power that was in some ways undefined because the very point of it was that it could change, expand in order to respond to circumstances of the moment. And so it's, I guess it's sort of like the way an originalist thinks about the due process clause. You know, we accept that there are provisions that the founders themselves knew or understood to be rather open-ended and could change over time. Doesn't mean it's exactly the same as this common law constitution, because there are common law, there's something size criticized presidents for, with which I agree. You know, if presidents are out there saying I get to spend money without appropriation from the Treasury, I think that is unconstitutional. He didn't mention, you know, we have a disagreement about DACA. You know, could a president just say I will not enforce this law at all? Is that faithful to the Take Care Clause? But I think there's something in between this kind of strict enumeration of powers and then this this imperial presidency that Schlesinger claims came into existence. I will add just as a footnote that before Vietnam, Schlesinger was a big cheerleader for the imperial presidency. In fact, he famously testified before Congress that in the age of nuclear weapons, limits on the presidency were obsolete and anachronistic. And it was only after Vietnam that he suddenly decided to become an originalist. And I have to add, he was not an originalist probably on any other constitutional question other than presidential powers.
I agree with much of what John said. Certainly about what he said about Schlesinger. I think, you know, Professor Green has ably marked out the three categories. And John and I are both originalists, and we just come to different conclusions. I'm in category one, and he's in category two. Someone who's in category three, the interesting thing about being in category three is you can say these are our practices, and these are lawful, and that's certainly a useful thing to say. But what's odd about category three is I think it's impossible to say, and these practices can't change. And I think it's also difficult to say, and the president's doing something illegal. Because it's often possible to say that there's some precedent out there that's relevant that suggests that the president can do what he's doing, right? The next president who wants to spend money without an appropriation, say in an emergency, can cite a Bush and Obama and the auto bailout, right? Can cite Lincoln, might even be able to cite the insurance company subsidies. So there are all kinds of, you know, examples of presidents doing things that may have been problematic at one time, but that now can now be cited as a constraint. And so it's possible to be in the third category and have some view that the presidency is now finally fixed. But I think that if you're in the third category, it's really hard to believe that, because you're basically, I think, subscribing to a view that the presidency does in fact change over time. Whether it ought to is another question, but does in fact change. And once you have that view, I think there are no permanent boundaries around it. Great question.
Thank you. And there's a question from the crowd that maybe a brief one is that, what about the War Powers Resolution? And I don't know whether you would think of it in terms of a sort of resolution that wasn't sort of gone through all the legislative processes. So maybe it's not really a statute, or maybe some idea that the presidential powers might override that. The question from the crowd is sort of, what would that conflict look like if someone tried to use the War Powers Resolution successfully against the president, as opposed to, I gather, what's the current practice of partial and episodic compliance?
I would, not to cast aspersions on Sai, you know, I do that all the time, but I think on this one, Sai would have to think that you, if you could get over standing, suppose you were a soldier called up to be sent to a war that Congress has not approved, and that does not fall within the 60-day clock of the War Powers Resolution. So the 1990-91 Gulf War, for example, went well beyond 60 days in terms of deployment to a hostile theater where hostilities could be possible. I think Sai would have to say that the war is unconstitutional. There's been no congressional declaration, and there's been no, and the War Powers Resolution makes clear, if we don't issue a declaration authorization, then it's cut off. I think it's typical of congressional posturing without any real desire to use its actual constitutional powers to take the president on. Because all Congress would have to do is just put a whole bunch of conditions on the spending power, and on the funding that it's given under the spending power to the Defense Department, and there would be no wars. And this is how the Vietnam War ended. Right? The Vietnam War doesn't end by Congress issuing an undeclaration of war, a repeal of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. Instead, Congress just puts a funding ban and says no funds can be used to conduct hostilities in Southeast Asia. President Ford immediately obeys it, and the war is over. That's also how the Mexican-American War of 1848 ends. People forget that President Polk actually was considering annexing all of Mexico. And actually, there were troops, if you recall, occupying Mexico City and throughout the country. And actually, Congress cut off all funds for the war, and Polk had to withdraw. But Polk actually had much grander designs, which Congress easily... My point is that it's Congress can do it if it wants, and they know how to do it. And anyways, dealt with Congress, when Congress wants to get something done, they're very good at using the spending power either as a battering ram or as a scalpel to achieve its goals. The War Powers Resolution to me is just symbolic legislation. Nobody obeys. Everybody pretends isn't even there. And it's a good example of, to me, just sort of symbolic, useless congressional action.
I agree with some of what John said. I think that to go back to the War Powers Act, you have to think about what it says and what it does, right? And what it purports to do is set out a vision of the president's constitutional powers to use military force in three limited circumstances. And then what it further says is, you know, unless Congress approves of some use of military force, the president can continue using military force for 60 or 90 days. And the problem is that modern presidents read the War Powers Act as if it said you can wage war for 60 or 90 days. If you read it very carefully, it doesn't say that. But it's been construed that way, and maybe you can understand why it might be construed that way, even if you think that that is a mistake. It actually was passed into law over Nixon's veto. So it's not some sort of, you know, National Corvette Day resolution that doesn't purport to be law. Has it been a failure or a success? I think most people think it's a failure because we have all these sort of uses of force or wars by presidents, notwithstanding the War Powers Resolution. And to really judge whether it's been a failure or a success, you have to ask the counterfactual. How many uses of force would there have been? How long would they have been conducted had there been no War Powers Act? And as many, you know, however many uses of force there have been since 73 or 74, you have to ask, would there be 2x or 1.5x, or would they have lasted longer? And I think it's quite possible that it has been a constraint, certainly maybe in its earlier years as compared to now. You know, I think the Obama administration's claim that there were no hostilities in Libya because we were bombing from the sky was quite frankly silly. The OLC certainly didn't endorse it. It was the White House counsel and the State Department legal advisor that made that claim. As I tell my class, if Canada bombed us from the sky, I think we would consider that hostilities.
Not if it was from Canada.
There would be polite bombs, very polite bombs. So I don't know if it's been an utter, I don't think it's been an utter failure. I think it's had some success because I think it's deterred some actions maybe shortened others. In terms of Congress using its authorities, I'm not sure what Eric's referring to, and maybe he's referring to these disapproval resolutions. There actually were two disapproval resolutions during this administration with respect to Yemen and Iran, and the president vetoed those. So it's I think the War Powers Act has a one-house disapproval resolution mechanism. That's unconstitutional after Chadha. So they used a two-house situation, and the president vetoed those. And it's an interesting situation the Congress finds itself in where it has to pass legislation to disapprove of what the president does, and then the president can veto it. John's appropriations answer, I think, is right in the sense that there is this appropriations check on the executive, and that Congress is afraid to use it because they're afraid of being labeled as unsupportive of the troops. But eventually, they might get the gumption to do it. They did it in Vietnam. After repealing the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, they eventually did cut off the funds. I think they talked about it when when George W. Bush was in office with respect to Iraq, but couldn't bring themselves to do it. But the fact that there is an ex post check does not mean there's no ex ante check. And so I think John's right that there is this funding cutoff in the Constitution, but that doesn't mean that there isn't another means of limiting the executive's ability to wage war, and I think that is the declare war clause.
Great, so here's another question for me. Another way of thinking of maybe the division is, I think if anyone asked the question, can presidents write laws? Maybe no one would say yes. And can presidents make treaties? No one would say yes. Can presidents declare war? So I think no one would say yes. And then it has to do with whether there's a functional approximation or anything in the gesture of that direction, maybe even almost to a functional identity between some of the things presidents can do and those things that have at least nominal and perhaps institutional differences from those terms. And one of the things that I thought of, maybe thinking about traditions or whatever, are the prize cases with Lincoln and sort of this idea of whether who has the power to respond with a blockade, whether that falls within war powers that require a congressional declaration, or are they something else that might be able to be done? And I think the dissent in that case makes a pretty strong formalist argument that there's only one sovereign, only one Congress, and only one declaration of war, only one thing that war things can go with, and the blockade being one of those. So whether you think of it in the context of prize case or otherwise, is the debate between the two of you something about the difference between some formal categorization of things that are off the president alone table and some disagreement about some range of potentially variable stuff that amounts to more or less the same thing as the prohibited categories?
Actually, I was going to suggest, in addition to the blockade at the beginning of the Civil War, is the Cuban Missile Crisis, which nobody complains about. Where's the declaration of war for that, right? The President Kennedy blockaded Cuba, which had nuclear missiles on it, which were being built to launch on the United States. We blockaded Cuba for 2 weeks, right? Remember, the name of the book is 13 Days, and nobody raises a peep about a declaration of war. Kennedy never gets one. It's a stark contrast to the prize cases. I think it shows, to me anyway, no one doubts the president can act in this way. But maybe I would take your question in this direction. Yes, you could see that you could see the executive branch that way. You could say, okay, the president can do these things. He can't do those things. I would agree formally. And also, I agree with you, Professor Green. You're quite right. Functionally, the presidents have acquired power to do things that are very close to or functionally the same as doing. So you said presidents can't make law, but they issue thousands of regulations a month, which have the force of law. Right? But my point is that the president can't do any of these things without Congress cooperating. Right? So the regulations are all through delegated powers. If Congress doesn't want presidents making trade agreements, they don't have to approve them, right? If Congress doesn't want presidents imposing a blockade around Cuba, They can defund those. And so the question is, why does that functional arrangement happen in response to your, and my point is, so the founders, I think they rejected this idea, this sort of legalistic approach to the separation of powers where we could look at the Constitution and say, that's on the list, that's not on the list. I think instead they expected the president and the Congress to fight. Remember Federalist 49, right, in 51, they both talk about this dynamic separation of powers where the Constitution works when each branch uses its constitutional powers against each other. So they would say in response to President's question, well, yeah, maybe presidents are trying to grab more and more lawmaking power, but that's up to Congress to stop them. And they have the institutional incentive to stop them. And rather than going to court and saying, oh, there is, you know, this clear demarcation of executive and legislative powers. Remember, this is where the founders say, you know, ambition must counteract ambition. And the ambition of the man will be connected to the ambition of the place, you know, that the person who, and this is my point of my book, is that I don't think Trump thinks about the Constitution all the time, probably doesn't think about it very often. But all the founders thought would happen would be if he pursues the self-interest of the branch and himself, that's how the Constitution will function. So I've so made such a devastating point has left the field.
So let me respond to what John just said. I think it's a very interesting point. I think John is on the horns of a dilemma. John, you know, believes that the president doesn't have authority over pandemics, and he believes the president can't set enforcement priorities or, you know, administratively enact DACA or DAPA. And that's fine. That's actually, you know, it's congenial to what I would think, or at least the framework is congenial, that there are limits on the executive. But John simultaneously says, well, the executive power isn't a laundry list, and it can change to deal with circumstances and emergency situations. Well, then I don't understand why it can't cover the pandemic, and I don't know why it can't expand to cover DACA and DAPA. And the answer can't be, well, that's the take care clause, because if the vesting clause can expand over time, it can expand over time, and there's nothing illegal about, you know, he is taking care that the laws be faithfully executed if he uses his pardon power, right? And he's, if he's using his discretion that's acquired through the vesting clause. So I think the problem with John's theory is it's at war with itself. Either he believes there are some ascertainable limits to the grant of presidential power in the Constitution, or there isn't. And if there isn't any such limits, then his concerns about DACA or pandemic powers are really, I think, a concern about, well, maybe the president hasn't acquired those powers yet, but he could over time, right? So it's not a fixed sort of category of what he can or can't do. With respect to Professor Green's question about, you know, functional equivalence, my point about declarations is they believed in the functional equivalence and the legal equivalence of these two types of declarations. They call the attack on another nation a declaration of war. And so when our Constitution talks about the power to declare war, it's covering all species of declarations of war and not just the formal kind. And we know this because they say the president can't attack another nation because doing so would be declaring war. With respect to treaties, I don't think the president gets to call something an agreement or a convention and avoid the treaty clause, right? And so those are treaties. And in fact, on the international plane, NAFTA is a treaty. It's not, you know, it's not treated as something else. And so the label just can't matter. And then I'd finally say with respect to laws, you know, if all that we mean when we say that the president can't make law is that he can't go into the Senate well and vote, and he can't go into the House floor and vote, that's a meaningless restriction, right? Because all it's really saying is he can't make law in this way, but he can make law in some other way. And I don't think anybody has that sort of that narrow view of the president. I think, you know, maybe someone like Vermeule and Posner do when they say that they have this argument that the president, you know, members of Congress can't delegate their votes, but they can delegate the authority to make law, which I think is an implausible reading of the Constitution. But again, a great question from Professor.
Let me just make one, not correction, but response to what Cy said. So Cy said it's my dilemma to have an originalist approach, but also claim that the executive power can expand in circumstances like emergency. I wish it were my dilemma, but I have to confess it is the framer's dilemma. And it is actually the dilemma of political theory, going back to Machiavelli, which is how do you, right? This is a great title of Harvey Mansfield's book about the presidency, right? Taming the Prince. How do you have something in the government that can respond to things like emergencies, but also subject it to the law? And it is, so I am going to attack Cy, because Cy here is made it clear. This is the dirtiest words in my book. He is a Jeffersonian, right? Because how does Jefferson solve this dilemma with the Louisiana Purchase, which he thinks is unconstitutional? Jefferson thought the Louisiana Purchase was unconstitutional. Jefferson says, I don't want the Constitution to expand. You know, Cy and Jefferson are the strict constructionists. And so Jefferson says, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to admit it's illegal, but I'm going to do it because it's such a great deal. The prices are too low. No American can resist a great land bargain. And he goes ahead and does it. And then later he says, well, I'm going to call that the prerogative. I'm going to say that I can act illegally, and I ask the people to approve it, because that way I can keep the rest of the Constitution pure. And I would say I'm a Hamiltonian. I think Hamilton, like Jackson, like Lincoln, believe that this has to be domesticated within the Constitution itself. It can't be some power that just free floats outside. And so they found that power in the, right, the grant of the executive power.
There are a couple of questions that link together in terms of the enforcement of institutional limits on the presidency. And I think one can see sort of various cases where courts use justiciability doctrine or mootness or deference, perhaps, to avoid more thorny or difficult presidential power questions. And then you see other calls for courts to become very involved. Or maybe the proper institutional balance, which I think I'm hearing from Professor Yu, is the sort of cooperative or sometimes even implicit acquiescence between the political branches, Congress, and the presidency. Or maybe the accountability rests in some deeper way with the American public, and the way to enforce constitutional principles and limits is not necessarily through legal institutions, nor even through interbranch conflicts, but directly through the enforcement of constitutional norms in elections. And I wonder what sort of the role of courts or of branches or of elections is in determining the true presidential power.
Sorry,
I'll take a crack, because John said I have some view about the courts enforcing all this. My book actually doesn't really talk too much about the courts, because I'm trying to describe what I take to be the president's powers in the 18th century and how they've, you know, expanded over time. And that story can be told in part without mentioning the courts. Obviously, the courts are playing a role in curbing executive power. We know that the separation of judicial power from executive power is in part designed in England and in the United States so that one can check the other, right? The judiciary can check the executive. You can't send someone to jail, right? Without a trial, you can't hold them indefinitely. These are sort of checks that the judiciary wields on the executive. They're accepted checks. No one really calls them into question, at least not yet. But I don't have to have a theory that the courts have to check every, you know, war, you know, every war started by a president. I will say that it's a problem for John's theory that justices of the Supreme Court said that the president couldn't start a war, going back to, you know, the Federalist courts of the late 18th century. We're talking about, you know, Wilson and Jay. And it's a problem for John's theory that, you know, the courts occasionally said the president and the executive branch acted ultra vires and allowed damage actions to go against naval captains for exceeding or taking actions in excess of statutory authority, which I think is odd if you think the president can just wage war on his own authority. So I don't have a particular view on what role the court should play in all this with respect to war powers. With respect to the modern era, it's curious that the question assumes that the courts are shrinking from these cases. I see a mixture of shrinking and leaping, right? I see some judges, what Trump would say are, you know, Democratic judges, just straining and stretching to strike down whatever President Trump is doing. And maybe, you know, someone could say that Republican judges are doing the opposite. I don't really see that, but I suppose that's possible, that Republican judges are giving the president every benefit of the doubt. Maybe some would say that about the travel ban case. But I don't think, as a, you know, I think there are certainly portions of the judiciary today that have no problem trying to stop the executive and may in some sense view themselves as part of the resistance to the president, reaching some results that just seem baffling to me. I know, you know, John doesn't think much of the Chief Justice's opinion with respect to DACA and DAPA, and I've read it and I'm kind of curious about it. It seems to impose sort of APA straitjackets on the administration for retracting a policy that the administration and that several judges think is illegal. Requires a sort of large explanation in a way that seems just curious to me. Maybe it's a, you know, one day ticket only that's designed to stop DAPA and DACA.
John, did you want to say?
Yeah, I'll just say very quick. I actually think the record of the courts actually sort of proves my point. Yeah, Sai's right. There have been these minor cases where the Supreme Court has dealt with the legal consequences domestically of war, like who gets to keep cargo when it's seized during wartime. That's actually, if you remember Professor Green's point about the cases at the beginning of the Civil War, like the they're called the prize cases because they're really about who gets to keep cargo that's seized during the blockade. The Supreme Court never has intervened in the war, actually the beginning of a war. I actually think it's fine for the courts and Congress to say, well, here are the legal consequences of the war after, but the courts have always stayed out of the question of, is this war itself constitutional or not? And they just, I think that shows, I think that they recognize that it's supposed to be a dynamic relationship and that if Congress wants to stop the war, then let them go ahead and stop the war. Why should courts try to claim they have the right to demarcate the exact border between the president and Congress in wartime? I think in terms of justiciability, you see this, if I think the Constitution were as Sai says, you would expect to see a lot of Supreme Court cases about presidential power. But in fact, if you were to, as I do, I think maybe we all do, have taught classes about presidential power, there are like no cases to teach. Right? I mean, just like there's just like maybe a handful at the Supreme Court. There are more at the lower courts. But you know, what's the major Supreme Court case on executive privilege? It's still U.S. versus Nixon from the 1970s. There's just, there really aren't that many. And executive privilege is a minor part of presidential power. There's no power, but there's no case about the pardon power, really. You could go on, and there's no case about the war power. All the power, actually, all the cases seem to be, and one of my colleagues once asked me about this. He says, why are all the presidential power cases about firing people? Who cares? Like, why is that? You wouldn't think about, oh, we're electing this president, except to tell Trump. We never would have said, we're electing this president to fire people, right? This is not that important. That's my point. That's because the real line between the president and Congress is not set by the courts. It's set by the history of the presidents and Congress using their constitutional authority in a dynamic way.
All right, great. Thank you, everyone. We've just hit our time. So I just want to thank the speakers and moderator for joining us. And on behalf of Penn Federalist Society and Temple Federalist Society, thank you to everyone who attended and especially those who stuck around till the end.